there. Before you start listening, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast. This episode contains language and content of an explicit nature. Listener discretion is advised. Before a song is released, a record is produced, or a chorus is written, the musicians that write them think a lot. They live a lot, and they feel a lot. Before the chorus dives into the stories and experiences that shape these artists, and ultimately, the music we hear. I'm your host, Sophia Lopercaro, and this episode's guest is X-Ambassadors.
I'm a small town guy in my heart forever. You know, I can't run away from the fact that, you know, I will always have a bit of this chip on my shoulder, and I'll always have a bit of this feeling of displacement.
Hey, welcome to this week's episode of Before the Chorus with me, your host, Sophia Lopercaro. I hope that you've had a great weekend. I hope you've had a great week. Or if you're listening to this at a later date, I hope things are just going well in general. Per usual, it has been a very busy week on my end. I'm trying slowly but surely to find some balance and rest somewhere in all of this. But yeah, that's a work in progress. So I'll report back when I figure out how to get enough nights in and sleep. But in the meantime, I got to go to some really fantastic gigs over the last week. I went to two gigs back to back on Saturday night. First of all, my friend Azurai Moon played the Hotel Cafe in Hollywood, and then a bunch of our friend group all jetted off to Black Rabbit Rose, which is literally just a quick little walk away, to go and see our friend Ash Minor play a show over there. Azurai is also in Ash's band, so it was kind of, again, we just got a whole gang of all of our friends together to go to the two shows, and it was so much fun. Two very different vibes. I mean, Azurai pulls from everything from neo jazz to classic rock, so put on a great show in that regard. And then Ash pulls a lot more from soul and blues and neo soul, so we got to enjoy some stuff in those vibes as well. The following night, I found a new emerging artist showcase to go to, if you will, called The Porch Sessions, run by a group called Wonder and Awe. It reminded me of when I used to go to So Far Sound shows in London, back when I used to volunteer for them, and we'd all be in a living room all huddled together enjoying really great music. Normally, as the name suggests, porch sessions are on a porch, but we had some really shit weather in LA this past weekend, or not this past weekend, it'll be the weekend prior by the time that this episode comes out, but we ended up doing it in a living room, and again, it was fantastic. The bands that were on were Sid Matisse, Dizelle, James the Eighth, and Gilbert Louis Ray. All of them were fantastic. I highly recommend going to check them out online. Also, I think I've mentioned this in previous episodes, but I started taking guitar lessons about, I want to say, 2.5 months ago, and I think it's one of my favorite things that I've done for myself recently. Something that I've learned as a musician and as a creator myself, especially as someone who is neurodivergent, that you really have to allow yourself to create music, to learn how to create music, to practice in a way that feels right to you. For example, for a lot of people, when they're learning a new instrument, they just start to kind of grab it and play it until they figure out what sounds right and what doesn't. For me, the way that my brain works, I get really overwhelmed really easily, and having that much choice freaks me out. So instead of approaching it, I just avoid it. I'm the kind of person that really thrives with at least a base level of structure that I can then use as a jumping off point. You know, I don't have to stick within the structure, but I need it as a sort of base. And for the longest time, because I was not someone that was actively just going and like messing around with a guitar, I always felt like I had this sort of like complex that made me feel like I didn't care enough about it. So I just never tried. And as I've kind of gone on a journey over the last, I want to say almost a year, of really learning how to respect how my brain works and be at peace with the fact that I operate in a different way, I've been able to stop avoiding making music, avoiding learning how to make music. I found a teacher that really fits the way that I like to learn. And I'm slowly but surely doing things that I've wanted to do, such as actively writing music, writing with other people, performing more. I'm finally doing all of this, and I'm not avoiding it as much. So the reason I share this with you is because I hope that whatever it is that you do in your life, whether it be also making music or doing some other creative pursuit or even something entirely different, I hope that you respect the way that you work, the way that makes sense to you. It doesn't have to look the same way as it does for other people. And I know for myself, finally giving myself that permission has helped me undo years of avoidance and self-loathing. So yeah, I guess find what works for you and respect what works for other people. You know, take other people's advice, but take it with a grain of salt. Ultimately, it's your call how you operate and what works most effectively for you. So yeah, I kind of just wanted to share that today. Moving on now, though, to my interview with Sam Harris from X Ambassadors. I remember the first time that I saw X Ambassadors was, I think, almost exactly 10 years ago. I was still living in my hometown of Montreal. I was on an extended break from college. We used to get like a month-long holiday break. It was really crazy. But me and my best friend went to go and see Imagine Dragons at the Bell Centre, which is Montreal's, I mean, it's where the Montreal Canadiens, our hockey team, play, but it's also where bands do arena tours. And initially, me and my friend had got pit tickets, and I was super excited. And she ended up either, I forget if she broke her ankle or her leg, but either way, she was on crutches. And so we got moved up to a seated area. And I was admittedly kind of bummed because I was so excited to be in the pit. But something really cool happened, which was that X Ambassadors opened for Imagine Dragons, and they did a meet and greet, and it happened to be happening just outside the exit nearest to our seats. So me and my best friend met Sam after having got to see them perform for the first time, and it was really cool. It's kind of one of those, like, you know, things didn't work out the way they were initially supposed to, but they ended up working out in a totally different but really cool way. Now, fast forward to 10 years later to the present day, and I was told that they were releasing their new album, Townie, and we ended up deciding to organize this interview. And I've come to have a new appreciation for X Ambassadors music, for the sort of earnestness from which they write. Honestly, if I'm showing my bias here a little bit, this is amongst my favorite interviews that I've done on this podcast and that I've done in general, because Sam was so willing to share stories from this record, and we had a really profound and lovely conversation, and I'm so grateful to him for his time, but also for his willingness to share so much. You know, we talked a lot about all the kind of weird dualities that come up when you're a kid growing up in a small town, like learning how to appreciate where you're from, but also recognizing that the restlessness that you felt as a kid is what got you out to travel the world. And learning how to let those two things coexist is a process. So with all that in mind, I'm going to leave you to my interview with X Ambassadors. I'm excited about this one. I really loved this record. And
thank you.
You're welcome. There is a quote that I found of yours that I felt like really hit home on the sort of theme of this record. And that was, you can't hide who you are, and who you are is where you're from.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I truly believe that. I think that I really, really tried hard to reinvent myself completely when I left town when I was 17. I like moved to New York City, and I was already like so obsessed with everything, you know, New York, and like that whole scene. The like early 2000s indie rock kind of like, I guess they call it now like
Indie sleaze.
the indie sleaze scene that was happening in New York at the time. And I was trying my best to like dress like that, even upstate in Ithaca, you know. I was like, and then so finally, when I got there, I just wanted to wash myself clean of this place that I kind of like poo-pooed, you know, as like small, too small town for me. But I'm a small town guy in my heart forever, you know. I can't run away from the fact that, you know, I will always have a bit of this chip on my shoulder, and I'll always have a bit of this feeling of displacement. I'll always in these big cities that I found myself living in for the last, you know, 20 years or so, I've never quite felt like I belong. And I don't know if I ever will. And even in my hometown, even when I go home, I mean, I do feel this sense of calm, this insane sense of calm wash over me. Like I kind of like I've been like I woke up from a dream, right? Where I like wake up in my mom's house downtown, and I look out the window, and I'm like, damn, I had the craziest dream that I was like, I lived in New York, and then I lived in LA, and I started a band, and I went on tour, and you know, we sold some records, and now I'm back here. You know, it's kind of, even though I do feel like that, I feel this kind of familiarity with that place. I'll even feel out of place there, you know, but that's just because I am a townie in my heart. And
Yeah.
that restlessness will always kind of be with me. And the more I try and deny that, the more I'm wasting my time.
Yeah. I feel like you also speak about that concept of restlessness in both positive and negative ways on this record. Like, there's definitely a gratitude of, like, you know, this sort of like fire got me out of this place and got me to travel, got me to, like you said, sell records and do everything that you've done in the last decade. But simultaneously, it's the thing that maybe made you distance yourself. So it's interesting how, like, do you feel like this record kind of holds that duality?
I think it really does. I think that I am so frustrated. Yes, I mean they're like that restlessness propelled me out into the world, and I do think that traveling and being in new places, experiencing different cultures, talking to new people, is just the biggest empathy machine ever, you know. Like it really does. It makes you realize how small this little world is, and how similar we are in so many ways. But I also am tortured a little bit by my own kind of restless energy. And I really wanted to, on this record, try and figure out why I've gone like this with the world, why I've like, you know, thrown myself out there. And I don't know. I mean, I came up with honestly more questions than I did answers, I think, making it. But I definitely realized how scared I was as a kid of being forgotten, of being, you know, overlooked, or being invisible, or being left behind. That was terrifying for me, you know, that notion. And you know, you could chalk that up to a couple of different things in my childhood, but I don't know. I think that's definitely something that still haunts me, that I'm always afraid that I'm like not keeping up, you know, or that I'm not doing enough, or that I'm falling behind somehow, and that I'm gonna just disappear and fade away, and that scares me
Yeah.
desperately. But you know, I think the truth is we all eventually do, and it's hard to reckon with that.
Yeah, it is. And I think those of us that are creatives definitely feel that in a very deep way. Like, we kind of in this in the in a sort of not spiritual or in a deeply emotional way, like, want to leave our mark on the world. And speaking of the two things you just said, like, one of my favorite songs on this record is First Damn. And I think it's because, like, that feeling of wanting to be seen, like, spelled out. It's such a vulnerable song, and it kind of allows itself to, like, sit with, like, the ugly and, like, the strange emotions of, like, you know, like, yeah. I broke my leg, or I broke, like, I forget what the injury was, but, like, there was something weirdly nice about being seen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I love
that attention, right?
I love the honesty of that song.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I love that one too. That one's such a, it's been kind of rearing its head a little bit since the record came out. A couple of people have mentioned that it's their favorite. And, you know, it was such an afterthought of a song. I had this idea to structure the album around the dams that are in Ithaca. There's First Dam, Second Dam, and Third Dam. First Dam. So I was going to have like these little interludes. Each song was going to be like a, you know, however long First Dam is, maybe like a minute, 30 yeah. seconds long. And there'd be three of them throughout the record, but I only got around to one. But it's okay. It's fine. The record turned out fine anyway.
It did.
But that one, I was like, all right, okay, First Dam. What happened to me at First Dam? What's a song I could write about that? And I remembered that time when I broke my nose there. And it was I was 13 and I was first, like, I was just kind of like getting into this phase of my life where I was starting to experiment with personalities and I was like, it's like right in the middle of middle school. It's the worst time. I mean, you're just like,
so bad.
I was a new person every week. I was a new person every week. And like, and I was so, God, I was so insecure and so like, just lost. I remember sixth and seventh grade were just the most painful transition from like elementary school to like middle school and like everything that goes along with that. I was, anyway, so I'm at First Dam, I broke my nose and, I like just started smoking weed and we just smoked weed and I was so paranoid and I like had all this blood gushing out of my nose. We go to this stranger's house. We call the ambulance, the cops come. So I'm like freaking out. I think I'm gonna get arrested and I'm like bleeding and my friends are all paranoid too. And it was so funny at the time. So I wrote about that. And then I had to kind of be like, all right, well, what's really here? Right. You know, like I've got this story, I've got this memory, but what's at the core of it? Why am I suddenly thinking of this again? Why am I latching onto this? Why am I also presenting it in this very kind of like somber way? Yeah. And I think I thought more about it and I remembered that feeling of like being lifted up into the back of the ambulance and I'm like kind of waving like I'm a king or a queen on like the palanquin or palanquin.
Yeah.
I forget how you pronounce it.
Palanquin, whatever it was.
To
yeah.
your, you know, to my subjects. And that felt really good. And then I thought, oh shit, you know, I love to put my pain on display and my kind of emotional trauma on display. That's my job. Why did I choose this? Why did I choose this job? You know, why, what is it about this thing where I'm like, I really want people to see, you know, something painful and vulnerable inside of me? Probably because I want attention in some ways. You know, it's not the only reason why, but it's a reason.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's an uncomfortable truth that I had to reckon with. I was like, man, I want to be loved, you know, I want to be seen. I don't want to be invisible.
Yeah.
So this is how I do it.
I mean, I think we all have that in us, and I think, but especially those of us that are creatives, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think it just depends on how you channel it and what degree of self-awareness
right.
you have around it. Because I've seen, yeah. as a person that works in music, I've seen every possible version of that. And I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah.
The best and the worst.
Yes.
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 That's a loaded yes. Yeah, that's a loaded yes, and same. So anyway, we'll leave that at that. We don't need to get into the drama and the tea of working in the music world in Los Angeles.
Man. There's too much. It's boring at this point.
Yeah, no, we're not even going to attempt to go there. One place I kind of want to stop at with this is kind of going back to this concept of like teenage restlessness, especially growing up in a small town. There's another record, and I hate that I now have to do this, but unfortunately it's a record by someone that we've since found out is not a great person. And I feel like if I don't mention this, then I'm like platforming this shit person, but that record is The Suburbs by Arcade Fire.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. That record was a huge record. That band was a huge band for me.
Same. I mean, I'm from Montreal.
Man, it's such a strange thing that we're all dealing with now. It's like, how do you reckon with these two things where it's like, you know, there is a person behind this piece of art that you love, and you can still, I think you can still love that work, and that work can still have a special place in you. You don't have to love that person. You don't have to love what they did, but I don't know. I mean, it is complicated.
I think we kind of just have to learn how to hold both at the same time. It's not about removing one or the other. It's just acknowledging both facts. But the reason I bring it up.
Exactly.
Yeah. The reason I bring it up, though, is because that same sentiment. I mean, I think one commonality between, even though like suburban upbringing and like small town upbringing are different, I think the main kind of commonality is that they're both places where like individual identity can sometimes get really stifled, especially if you color outside the line, especially if you're like a teenage kid wearing women's jeans. Song reference. I do my job, but you know, like, and then when you put those two things together, like the sort of like boredom of being in a place, especially when you're a teenager, where you don't feel like there's things that, you know, excite and stimulate you, and you don't feel like you quite fit in. And there's so much of that restless energy, like on the opening track, Sunoco, on Smoke on the Highway, on No Strings, like that energy, like just kind of pulses throughout the whole record.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I felt it. I really did. I really did feel it. And, again, I think it drove me to make the kind of music that I, you know, made in the beginning of my career. I think back on our first record, and that record is so big. It's like big, 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 big. Everything had to be so big, because we came from this small place, and I was like, fuck, man, I need people to hear me. So I'm going to be loud. I'm going to make like big, bombastic kind of music.
You were like I was gonna say all the falsetto and the belt on Unsteady.
Yeah. Oh my god. I mean
it's a banger.
I was belting to the fucking moon, you know. I felt like I needed that. And what we did on this record was take some of that restless energy and keep it bottled up. Keep it bottled up the entire record and just kind of keep it there simmering below the surface. Cause that's really how it felt, growing up there. And, I also wanted to kind of challenge that within myself. Like, okay, Sam, maybe you don't have to like take up the most space in the world on this record. You can just be, try it. See what happens. And we turned out with a record that we really love.
Yeah. And I mean, there's such a place for both of them. Like, I think having a song like where you probably had like a lot, like again, going back to something like Unsteady, where you're letting all of that big stuff out, that's great and that's important. And also, like, the reason I mentioned The Suburbs is, like, I grew up in a place that was somewhere halfway between a suburb and a small town. I grew up in an area called Saint-Lazare, which is about an hour outside of Montreal. And it's part of what we call the Greater Montreal area. So it's sort of a suburb, but has a small town feel. Like, it doesn't feel very manicured. It's like, and so that same feeling of being like, I don't quite fit in here, and I'm like the weird kid out. Like, I know that feeling so much. And also, I also for 1 year, my parents moved us down to Texas for a hot minute, and I lived in the suburb that The Suburbs is about.
Oh, wow. So you really, truly lived that album.
Yeah. Oh, like the like dead shopping malls rise like mountains beyond mountains. Like every time I'd be driving through this area called the Woodlands, Texas, I'd just be like, fuck, I know this feeling. So I've like, again, so like hearing this record now,
I mean,
County,
can we just put it all aside for a second and just fuck me. That record is so good.
It's good. It's
so good. It's like, so good.
It's like, Wynn Butler, why did you ruin this for all of us? But anyway.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, but yeah, it was, there's a book I read about it, one of the 33 and a third books where like someone like broke it down. And that idea of like, it's been a while since I've read it, but like the thing I was talking about, like individual identity being stifled, and you just get that restlessness of like, I don't belong here, and everything's kind of like a little too safe and a little too monotone. And again, even though small town, like growing up in a small town is slightly different, there is that same sort of element of like, again, like it's a feeling that I know, like I know that feeling of restlessness all too well, of being like, I need to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. And I saw, and like the thing that was really torture for me, I think, as a kid, torture, I had a lovely childhood. Look, I grew up in a fantastic place, but that aside.
Yeah.
The thing that was kind of torture for me was being so close. I mean, not so close. I'm a 5-hour drive away from New York City, but like in my mind, I'm in the same state that people associate with this place. That's the biggest fucking city. It's like the Mecca. That was like where I wanted to be. Instantly, as soon as I had any sort of semblance of taste of my own, I was like, I gotta go to New York. And there's this bigger world that was just right there. It's right there, you know? And there are people over there who also know about like wearing women's jeans from American Eagle, and like that's a vibe, you know? Like, whereas everybody at my school just made fun of me for it. You know, like, not in New York. In New York, that's cool. It's right there. And then also my dad worked in the film industry. My dad is a unit publicist. He's still fucking working, man. He's 75 and he's like still doing shit. He's a freelancer. So he's kind of like living what I live now. Always on the road, like going from job to job, kind of a vagabond, right? But he's like working on sets of fucking movies, on big movies. And I get to go visit him like once or twice a year while he was always gone, you know? So most of the time I was with my mom and my brother in Ithaca, but every once in a while we'd go visit my dad on set, and he's like surrounded by all these people who are making this piece of art, right? That will be out in the world. And it's fucking, I mean, there are movie stars, there's fucking like, it's crazy exotic locations. I get to see this as a kid. It was so insane. And then I go back home and get made fun of for wearing my fucking, you know, the clothes that I wear. And I'm like, fuck you. You don't know what's out there.
Yeah.
You know, it was a really wild, wild way to grow up. And I don't know where I was going with that point, but you know what I'm saying? It's like the tease of it always being there, I think made me even more restless to leave.
Oh, yeah, I feel that. I mean, like, because I was only an hour outside of the city, and, like, my cousins grew up in the city, so we'd go and, like, hang out with them at holidays, or, like, me and my friends, when I became a teenager, we'd take the train into town, like, when we were old enough to go by ourselves, so we'd go shopping at, like, Forever 21 and all that good shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know? What a time. What a fucking time. That,
yeah,
and, like,
what a time to be alive.
Yeah, like, we saving up to, like, buy something at, like, American Apparel. Like, those were the...
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
What a time. What a time that was to be alive.
What a time.
Yeah. But like, I know that feeling where it's close enough that you know it exists. And like, luckily there wasn't a little bit of like diversity within like where I grew up, like with like some of those like kind of feelings, but it never kind of reached its like full potential. So there was always that feeling of like, I don't know. And it was still like you were wearing that stuff because it was cool, not because like you could stand out. If you stood out in any way, they're like, okay, little weirdo, get back in your place.
Yeah.
I have lots of fun fun stories from that era of my life that
and you're so torn too because like there was definitely a part of me where it's like, you know, I would wear some crazy shit and I listened to music that not a lot of my friends listened to, but I also did listen to stuff that my friends listened to too, because I did want some sort of community, you know, like I wanted to be one of the gang. I wanted to be accepted, but then in a lot of ways I felt so different. So I was constantly, you know, at war with those two sides of myself.
Yeah.
And I definitely did my fair share of assimilation.
Yeah.
And I think that's natural too. And I kind of look back on that with almost more nostalgia now than like the kid who was so desperate to be different, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Like there's such a weird like duality, like talking about a song like Women's Jeans, where there's like those lines where you're like, I barely recognize myself anymore. And
the
funny thing with that is like, I got the sense that you know, that definitely lives in that era of your life where you were a kid and you were trying to assimilate. But there's also a sense of losing yourself later, like in other ways, like losing yourself in the industry or in New York or in LA or like all these other places. Yeah.
That song in particular, I love that one. And writing it was so fun because I got to use this part of my childhood as a metaphor for something greater, you know, which is that like, you know, I still feel like I'm that, you know, 13, 14 year old kid who still doesn't really know, who's just trying on costumes, trying to like find one that fits and changing it up feeling like I want to change it up every day, not knowing who I am. I think I'm at a weird point in my life right now. I'm in my mid 30s. I've been in the music industry for 17 years now. Like we've been in it for a long time, and I've done a lot. I still have things that I want to do. A lot of my friends are having families. They got kids now, you know. People are growing up. I'm seeing people get older. I'm seeing myself get older. I'm thinking about the future more. And I think there's that line in the chorus that I always think about, like the, who am I now? What if I've changed my mind? You know, I'm not who I thought I'd be. I still feel like that teenage boy in Women's Jeans trying to be somebody else. Like I still kind of feeling like I feel like I'm playing adult, you know, I adulting, right. Or whatever the fuck, you know, I don't care. I'm struggling now to figure out how to balance those feelings of like, I am this grown person now with all these experiences behind me, but I still feel like this kid who doesn't really know what to do and who to be. And I think that's kind of what I was going through when I wrote that song. Also specifically seeing my brother, you know, come into his own in such a magnificent way. My brother and I, you know, for so many years, I kind of took on the older brother role. I'm younger. I'm a year and a half, almost 2 years younger. And now seeing him, I spent so much of my time kind of like, in a way, taking care of him. And now he's taking care of these two kids that are, you know, his kids, and he's got a wife and he's got a house and he's like, he's chilling. And I kind of had to look at myself and be like, oh, all right, well, what about you, my friend? Who are you? What are you going to do? You know?
Yeah.
And I think there's that second verse, you know, where I'm happy you found your peace, but what about me? You know, when did I lose myself, and what do I owe myself?
Yeah.
Moving forward.
I mean, I think we all think, it's such a cheesy thing to say, but we all think we have, like someone else has their shit together more than us, but like there's a new set of existential crises that comes with every part of life. Even if, you know, you have a house and you have kids, like kids, I'm sure, like brings on its own existential.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine.
So the point is, like, I think everything will always be in flux. And the more I've found in my life that I can make peace with that, the less terrifying that concept becomes. Because it's like,
yeah.
I mean, I'll still jokingly say, like, oh, when I'm in my 30s, I'm going to, like, feel like I have my shit together. I know I'm not. Like, I kind of, like, just, like, lean into the delusion a little bit, but not too much.
Yeah. I think what does happen, though, is that you do kind of like, it's not like you kind of throw your hands up, but you throw your hands up a little bit at the universe in your 30s. You start to, at least you start to learn how to do that and be like, you know what? None of this shit is in my fucking control.
Yeah.
None of the shit's in my control. And things are always going to be in flux. I think there's been a lot of talk in my group of friends and that I've been thinking about lately and just shit that I've gone through in the last year or so, where you realize things are always in this kind of in-between space. And I have historically always wanted to feel like things are settled. Things have come to their proper conclusion, right? Whether it's like a relationship and with an ex, or, you know, or a relationship with a family member, or just like, I think about if somebody is in the hospital in a coma, right? A friend of mine was just in a coma for a while, and now has come out, and they're not the same. They're not going to maybe ever be the same. It's kind of this in between. It's like, I've lost my friend, but my friend is still here, you know? Yeah. And it's living in that in between space where that's where life is, you know, and you kind of have to get used to the idea of that. And in your 30s, I think that becomes more and more and more apparent, where like you're on this high in one place in your life, your career is going awesome, your relationships in the fucking toilet, or vice versa, you know?
Listen.
And you got to live in those in-between spaces.
Yeah, there'll always be something, again, always something in flux, always something that's not quite right. And it takes time to be okay with that. I feel like Fallout on this record kind of touches on a lot of the stuff that you just mentioned.
Yeah, yeah, I love that song. That is one that we just started playing on this tour, and the first night we were checking it, at soundcheck, our lighting guy comes up to me afterwards. He's like, holy shit, man, that one really got me today. He's like going through a divorce right now. So like, hit him, hit hard. That one, yeah, I mean, there's that line, couldn't face, it's like, I saw your boy at a party last night on State Street. Paranoid, heard your name, and I ran out the room. I couldn't face talking circles around the elephant, because under all that shit I talk, I still miss you.
Yep.
You know, there are people in my history who I have, you know, demonized in my mind. And like every time they come up in conversation, I'm like, that fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
Like I hate what they did to me. And I am such a victim here, and blah, 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 blah. And really underneath it all, it's like when you do that with either an ex romantic partner or a friend, and you see them again, you've spent all this time apart turning them into the fucking worst person in the world, and then the second you like run into them, and you have, I mean, most of the time it's like usually like, hi, polite, cordial, and then instantly you can like feel this, oh my God, I remember now why I loved you so much. Fuck.
Don't.
Okay. Oh, it's the worst.
Okay, that's...
It's the worst, right?
You can't... Okay. that, yeah, that wormed in into a place in my own psyche that, okay, I'm going to just sit with that for a moment. Yeah.
Oh, it's like so insane. It's so insane how instantly you're just like, oh my God, I remember it. I remember it all now. I remember it all. That, cause that's really underneath all that pain, you know? In that song, talking about, you know, this relationship that's just completely gone to shit. And, the chorus, I won't call you up. You won't dare to speak my name. Oh my God. Has it come down to this? There is no shelter anywhere from this fallout. You know, we made it clear there's no going back, but I keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
I keep revisiting these things, these relationships in my songs and my, you know, my head and my therapy, you know?
Yeah. There's a few more songs that I want to touch on. These ones I guess in everything that we've discussed so far, and like these things of like, you know, at times losing yourself, the like getting out of town and needing to leave. And I guess everything where it's like you can kind of like put up a wall, maybe inflate your own ego a little bit, you know, and come away. There's two songs that are kind of like the like putting ego in check kind of. And for me, that's Your Town and Rashad.
Yeah. Those are exactly that, you know. I think,
yeah,
you know, starting with Your Town, I wrote that about my teacher and one of my early mentors, not the person I was talking about.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Todd Peterson, who was a real fixture in the community in Ithaca. He was this queer black man from upstate New York who was a Broadway dancer for a number of years, came back upstate to be with his family, and started working at the elementary school where I went, working side by side with his sister, who's a vice principal. And Todd was every kid's like best friend, and like also the one that you did not want to cross. Like if you got in trouble, you were going to Todd, and Todd was gonna like yell at you. He was gonna dig into you, and like he knew how to like dig into you and make you cry. Todd could make anybody cry.
Amazing.
But also was just had the most generous, loving heart, and really cared about us kids, like really fucking did. And he, when I was in fourth or fifth grade, I was this really shy kid, you know, when I was that age. I loved to like kind of perform and play pretend at home, but you know, like I'd sing at home with my mom and my brother, but I've never sing in public. And he heard that I could sing, and he was like, you're gonna sing in this musical. We were doing like a musical about, it was like a made-up musical about women's suffrage, and wow. I sang this song. It's this old blues song, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. And I sang it off stage with a mic. I'm like shaking. I was so nervous. I couldn't even be on stage, but I did sing in front of a crowd of people for the first time. And that was because of him. And so that kind of sets the scene for my relationship with Todd. And throughout the years, he was always, I did a lot of musical theater growing up, a lot of theater. And he was always doing all the choreography for all the shows. So, you know, I'd be drilling these crazy dance sequences with him over and over and over again. He actually helped me get ready for some of my auditions for college and stuff, and just really was like always my champion. He was always in my corner. Not only did he work at the school and did all the choreography for the musical theater stuff, he also ran this day camp at the summer day camp called Stewart Park Day Camp. He was kind of the one in charge of the whole thing, and I was not only a camper there, but I was also a counselor there later. I worked for him. Anyways, when I left and started this band and we started doing our thing, you know, he was so proud. And when we went back home for the first time to play our first show back there in like 2016, it was like the greatest feeling in the world to just hug him and have him tell me how proud he was of me and you know, go back to our elementary school, meet all the kids. And it was really, really amazing. And then as the years went on, he would kind of like badger me a lot about not coming home enough, and like he would, you know, comment on shit on Instagram or like message me on Facebook. I never look at my Facebook account. I haven't looked at my Facebook account in fucking years, you know, but he'd always kind of nag me about like, why don't you come back and visit more? Like, don't forget about the little people. And I got annoyed. I got annoyed and I stopped responding. I stopped answering his calls. And little did I know that, he was really going through some stuff. I can't really speak on like what exactly was going on, cause I just don't know, but I think his,
and even then I wouldn't ask you to like,
No. But you know, I'm just saying this. I wish I did. I wish I did know, but I don't really, I think his mental health was deteriorating, and I think he also had some serious health issues that he wasn't talking about with anybody. When I found out he passed away, I was like so riddled with guilt and shame. And because I had ignored his calls for so long, and like I kind of like, I was like, I can't deal with this. I can't deal with you guilt tripping me right now about, you know, about like not coming back to Ithaca to like play in the kickball tournament, you know, like I can't, I got a busy life. And that really, really hurt when he died. And also he had left me this, he had called me and I'd screened his call and he had left this voicemail, which is the voicemail that you hear at the end of the song. Just saying that, you know, he wished I'd call more often, but that he had heard our new song and really loved it and wanted to say how proud he was. And I listened to the voicemail. I texted him. I was like, hey, Todd, sorry I missed your call. I'll call you back. And I never did. And so this song was me kind of reckoning with that. With that feeling of guilt and shame, about running away from the place and the people that, you know, raised me or such a big part of me. But also I think me writing the song was a way of forgiving myself too, a little bit, because I think that, you know, I can't keep beating myself up for not getting that call. You know, I can't. This is, you know, it's just life. You know, everybody's gotta live their own, you know? And, I don't know. It was really hard, it's definitely an ego check, you know? And like, I think it's important. I think it is really important for me now to, I think back on the people in my hometown who stayed, and how when I was like first living in New York and, you know, doing my thing, I was like, man, so glad I didn't end up like that dude who's like still there. And now I think I have so much more admiration and respect for those people who chose to stay in my town. Or chose to or had to. I don't know. How am I supposed to fucking know? You know, like, that song reckons with that a lot. The other one, what was the other one you asked about too?
Rashad. And also before we get to Rashad, I have to just mention about the video for Your Town, the bit where you're replicating the choreography from Todd's performance is, it's such a beautiful moment of like giving someone their flowers. So I think ultimately you are showing so much beautiful like gratitude towards him. So I hope you can hold on to that too. Like it's so beautifully done.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I think that we did. And I do feel like I've been able to say, you know, what I wanted to say to him in that way. Just wish I could have gotten a, you know, chance to say it to him in person.
I know. Well, going to Rashad, I think and again, it's that thing of, how do I put it? you know, when we feel like we've either lost ourselves or we're not like the version of ourselves we're supposed to be, these people that have like passed on maybe at an earlier point in our lives almost end up being these like anchors for like reflection, you know, of like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like Rashad was a friend of mine in middle school who, yeah, I mean, he passed away in this tragic accident at my school when he was 13. So like, that's a kid. That's a kid, you know? And it's weird because he pops up in my head when I'm going through, I remember around the time I wrote that song. This is so funny. I was like stressed out about something so stupid, like not posting enough on social media. Or like, God, like, what am I going to do about this camp? I got to like come up with a campaign for this new single. And like, oh, I wish that I didn't have to do this. And like, why do I have to? And then all of a sudden I'm thinking about him. And I'm thinking about like, God, I am stressed out about, at least I get to be stressed out about something. Yeah. Even if it wasn't something as innocuous as like, you know, like, what am I going to put up on TikTok today? You know, like, even if it was something heavier. At least I get to feel it, right?
Yeah.
At least I get to go through this thing. This is life, right? You have to feel these high highs and these low lows and everything in between. I am so lucky that I get the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
You know, when someone like him couldn't. And I think what I hope comes through in the song too, at least energetically, is that I so easily will forget. that thought comes into my head and I'm like, man, fuck, Sam, you should be so grateful to just be here and like to, you know, be on this planet and be able to breathe the air you're breathing and like experience all the things you're experiencing, the high highs and the high high and the high highs and the high lows and or low lows. And then my brain just goes right back to worrying about some other bullshit. I just forget it. You know, it's the hedonic treadmill, right? As human beings, we're so trained to like experience these high highs and low lows and then end up floating back in the middle somewhere. We get right back to it very quickly.
Yeah.
You know,
we don't know how to handle the middle.
Someone dies. Yeah. Someone dies and it's all you're thinking about and all it's all consuming for 2 days, and then on the third day, you know, you realize you forgot to send an email to somebody and you have to send that email. And then, oh my God, you remember again that this person is gone, and then you're hungry and you're like, oh man, if I go to that spot again, I'm gonna see that barista, and I just really don't like that barista. They always like ask me too many questions and I don't want to, you know, it's so funny the way that your brain works. And I wanted to kind of get that across in that song as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a human thing to be like that. And it's good to have those return to center moments. I'll add someone that kind of plays like that role for me in my life, like where Rashad's that kind of point of reflection for you, is a band called Hers that passed away in a car accident a few years ago. I don't know if you heard about them.
Oh my God. Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, that was five. Actually, the anniversary of their passing was a couple weeks ago, like 5 years. I didn't know them well, but I had interviewed them. I lived in the UK for many years, so like I knew a lot of people that knew them, that had toured with them. And when they passed away, I was in a period of dealing with really severe depression. And all of a sudden, I found myself grieving a death, like where I was going from, like, I don't see the point of life, everything feels so meaningless, to why am I suddenly angry that someone's life was taken away? And it sort of created this like wake up call for me of like, wait, I'm angry that these guys didn't get to like fill more time with like all of their art and all of the things that were supposed to happen for them. They were on their first ever US tour when they passed. Like, it was like they were on the cusp of so much. And that was such a, when that happened, it ended up serving as a big turning point for me of like,
yeah,
like you said, like where you said, it's like, at least like I get to feel this, at least I get to experience, like, life is so full of so much potential to fill with all of the good and the bad. And I don't want to, you know, not tap into that potential as long as I'm here. And so, yeah, I also actually have the flowers from their debut record on my arm, the tulip and the carnation.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Yeah, that fire you felt, that probably, like, in a way, you know, probably reminded you of, you know, the heat of your blood in your body running through your fucking veins, running through your body. And, like, that reminds you of being alive, and you feel, and how good it feels in a weird way, how good it feels to fucking breathe and to have that blood flowing through you. You know, it really, being angry can be such a great way to, like, get your feet back on the ground again.
Yeah. I just did an interview with some friends of mine called Another Sky, who are kind of label mates of y'all's. Highly recommend. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot about, like, the importance of anger, because they talk about it a lot on their record.
So important.
It's called Beach Day. Yeah. Again, highly, highly recommend. Really good stuff.
I'll check it out.
And yeah, they talk about it in such a powerful way, and, like, again, learning how to use it as, like, a driving force to help you move through life, move to change things, set boundaries, all that good stuff. So
it really can be such a beautiful thing to accept and use if you use it in the right way.
That's the key.
You know?
I think the last song that I want to talk about is Follow the Sound of My Voice, and I want to specifically talk about a certain set of lines, which I will pull up. So that line, that was actually, I think it's the bridge, which is, when I feel like I am stumbling in the dark and I get lost inside this great big world, when I feel like I'm invisible, like nobody cares, you're always there saying, I can see you. And what I love about this line is that I get the sense that whereas most of the song is about you taking care of your brother, it almost feels like this line flips it. Like, this is, and I could be wrong, but I read it as, like, you know, I can see who you are as a person, and it feels like a role reversal almost.
Exactly what it is. Yeah. I think that I am so lucky to have my brother with me for so much of the time, you know, when we're making records together, when we're on tour together. This is my job, you know, and I spend a lot of time doing my job, a lot of time working, and I can so easily be led astray and get lost and feel overwhelmed and feel like, what am I doing and what do I matter, and what does any of this matter? I get caught in the comparison loop like everybody else. You know, like I feel so much like an imposter. And then I look at my brother, and, you know, he's my brother, he's my family, and he knows me so well. He knows me, you know, better than most people. And that's very comforting to me. I also think that, like, a big part of our relationship, you know, it's so complicated in my head, but it's really simple, very simple. I love him. He loves me. We're very, very devoted to each other. And I do feel like I've learned a lot from him. And then just through the experience of, like, growing up as a kid with a brother who is blind, you know, like, I see the world differently, and I'm so lucky. And he has always just been this, like, pillar of stability, even in the most unstable of situations. Like, I know who I am when I look at him, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just so valuable. It's so valuable to me. The older I get, the more appreciative I am of that. And I've had to reckon with a lot of things too, you know. I think for a long time I was just so I was bitter in a lot of ways, because I was like, fuck, man, you know, like, I've given so much of myself away to this person and to this relationship and to this dynamic. Not realizing how much I get back from it. But I think the two go hand in hand, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that, for anybody who's, you know, been in a situation like I have been, growing up. Yeah, it's hard and also beautiful and really hard. There's a lot of sacrifice and there's a lot of there's a lot to gain from it at the same time.
Yeah. I think to kind of tie all the pieces of the record together through this song, like, you know, there's so much on this record about wanting to be seen and wanting to be validated, you know, trying to figure out who you are. And it feels like it all comes back again to, like you said, it's who you are is where you're from, and that includes your family. And it's also such a profound statement, you know, that given that it's a song about someone in your life who is blind, like, it's not about seeing in the, like, literal sense. It's, like, to be seen and, like, yeah. I see who you are.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. I mean, I think it's just kind of a full stop there. I feel very lucky to have grown up the way that I did, and to have grown up where I did, and raised by the people who raised me, and grew up alongside the people I grew up alongside. And I wanted to stop running away from it on this record, and I and turn back and kind of appreciate everybody and appreciate that part of me that's such a big part of me, so that I can maybe move on.
Yeah,
but also, you know, I don't know if I ever will, and that's okay.
Townie is available now wherever you normally get your music. This podcast is hosted, edited, and produced by myself, Sophia Lopercaro, and the artwork is by Meg Wilford.